Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. When it comes to investing, the methods people use to make choices often aren't rational. So how do you maintain intellectual independence? Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/herd. That's morganstanley.com/HERD. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. We're joined by Mike Grunwald of Politico Magazine, a longtime friend of mine and a master at telling big narrative stories about crucial policy issues. He's got a great one in the magazine now about the Gateway Project, a $30 billion infrastructure plan that would include a new $11 billion tunnel under the Hudson between New Jersey and New York City for passenger trains. It's a hugely personal issue for me as a New Jersey resident and frequent rider on the Acela Corridor that runs between Boston and Washington and frequently gets stuck between Newark and New York City. President Trump once seemed totally on board with Gateway, but the project is stalled and the White House is now a strong opponent. Mike, thanks so much for joining Politico Money.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ben. I'm thrilled for how successful this has been for you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I should note that Mike is joining us from Miami. He's a Floridian who's written extensively about Florida and the Everglades and lots of other cool stuff. So check out the Grunwald oeuvre if you haven't, because there's tons of good stuff in there. Let's start with an experience that you had recently at Union Station in Washington that you called the ultimate metaphor for America's infrastructure. What was it?
Oh, sure. It was funny. It was the day that I was meeting a guy named John Porcari, who used to be Obama's deputy transportation secretary and is now sort of in charge of this Gateway project that you mentioned. And we were going to ride the Acela train to check out some of those tunnels that are falling apart and that, you know, the portal bridge where trains get stuck. But first, you know, I met him there and he was like, hey, I want to show you something. And it was Infrastructure Week, believe it or not. They were setting up for the Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, was going to be making a speech in Union Station. But he said, look, I just want to show you sort of the story of American infrastructure. And he takes me up, we go in the elevator and we go to basically the roof of Union Station. Now, I don't know if you remember, I guess it was 2011, there was an earthquake in Washington. People remember it because it shut down there were like cracks in the Washington Monument and it shut it down for like a few years. But it also knocked a ceiling panel off of Union Station. And you know, that grand facade, they have that beautiful ceiling dome, a piece of the ceiling fell off and it could have killed somebody. But fortunately nobody was hit, but it turned out to be a very lucky thing because they went up and they looked behind the ceiling where Porcari took me. And what they found was pretty incredible. That grand vaulted dome, it turned out was being held up by 100-and-change-year-old plaster of Paris. There were some sort of dowels and you could kind of see some wooden stuff holding the roof together, but mostly they had kind of, it was like old rags dipped in plaster of Paris, essentially glued the ceiling to the top of Union Station. And they were kind of like, oh my God, what are we going to do about this? The sort of long story short is they did this $20 million renovation project that nobody noticed. They put up this incredible steel superstructure that you could see from, you know, that little crazy perch where I was with Porcari. Obviously, nobody could see it below. The only part of the $20 million renovation that anybody noticed, aside from the fact that there was like scaffolding in Union Station for 4 years, was American Express paid like $20,000 to sponsor the gold leaf paint because, you know, the gold card. So they got a lot of credit. But basically, the way Porcari saw it was like, here is, you know, nobody gets credit for the roof not collapsing and killing hundreds of people. But here was this incredibly dangerous situation that cost a lot of money to fix. And that's sort of America's problem right now. We have, you know, the pipes, the ceilings, the stuff that nobody sees, the sewer lines, the subway tunnels, they're falling apart. And it's going to cost a heck of a lot of money to fix it, but nobody's going to get credit for it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen estimates of, you know, $5 trillion. I think your piece mentioned the total in infrastructure projects that we would need to do to update a lot of the stuff that you're talking about that nobody sees, but is critical to, you know, the safety and the economics of the United States. And that is a great metaphor, the sort of hidden dangers of Union Station in D.C. and what it costs to replace them, and the fact that nobody could see it and nobody would really get credit for it outside of American Express, of course. Let's talk about the Achilles heel of transportation in the Northeast. Another thing that, you know, few people see or pay attention to, but is this incredibly critical piece of infrastructure that is really old, really rickety, and, you know, really slows down traffic in the Northeast Corridor on trains. Tell me about the Achilles heel of transportation in the Northeast.
Sure. Well, I mean, we're talking about basically that little patch for New Jersey Transit and Amtrak to get in between Newark and Manhattan. And, you know, this dates back 110 years for when they built these first tunnels, the tunnel under the Hudson River, which if you go in there now, which I got to see it from the back of an Acela train, it is crumbling, it's falling apart. In 2015, in the summer, they had a huge blowout of some of the electrical cable, and it basically shut down the city for 4 days. Then you have the Portal Bridge, which is this rickety old sort of this old swing bridge where it actually swings open whenever a boat needs to go underneath on the Hackensack River. And one in every seven times they open it, they can't close it. They actually sometimes have to come out with a sledgehammer and try and smash it back together so that the catenary system can work again. It's just it's pathetic. And you have like 450 trains a day that are stuck, and 200,000 commuters and tourists who can't get into New York City. It's really crazy. But again, this is funny, and I'm sure we'll talk about this big meeting where President Trump met with the New York and New Jersey members of Congress who support this thing. But even at this meeting, where Trump was very, very supportive, he said that fixing this stuff reminds him of fixing the air conditioning in the basement of his hotels. It's one of those things where you got to do it, and it costs a lot of money, but nobody's going to see it, and nobody's going to give you credit for it. And I think that, you know, so even the president, who has been, you know, the major obstacle to this project getting done, he sort of understands the politics of infrastructure.
I just want to stop for a second and reflect on the fact that this Portal Bridge carries all the New Jersey Transit and Amtrak trains into New York City, and, you know, a critical piece of infrastructure. And it swings open basically for garbage barges and sewage being taken up and down the Hackensack River. And sometimes it goes back into place, okay. And sometimes dudes have to come out with sledgehammers to bash it back into place. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about decrepit infrastructure in the United States. And it's just staggering when you stop and kind of think about it and look at it when you're going across it, that, you know, you're on this relic that, you know, might close all the way, might not close all the way. And yet it's taking all of these people into New York City. So obviously that needs to be fixed. Obviously, the tunnels you talk about in the piece that, you know, are 100 years old or older than that, that take all these trains in and out of Manhattan, are falling apart, cables falling down, and could paralyze the city more. And yet this project, the Gateway project to fix all of this and build a new tunnel, is stalled. And it didn't seem like it was going to be stalled. You just mentioned this meeting with Trump and the New York and New Jersey delegations in 2017, and everybody seemed to be in real good spirits about this. This thing is going to happen. It's not sexy, but it needs to be done. And Trump seemed to be on board. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, the meeting was, you know, I sort of got chapter and verse from it. But when I talked to people like Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, who, you know, obviously had run against President Trump, but President Trump was there. It was his birthday. Chuck Schumer was there, was like, hey, you should give Chris, a tunnel for his birthday. Everybody was laughing. Governor Cuomo was there. Trump was talking about how awesome the LaGuardia renovations were. He congratulated him on redoing the Tappan Zee Bridge. bridge. He kept calling him my governor. It was actually the day after really the one big bipartisan thing that Trump has done was that budget deal he did with Schumer last year. And Trump kept talking about how awesome that was. He was sitting next to Gary Cohn and Schumer was on the other side. And he kept reaching across Gary Cohn to shake Schumer's hand. Everybody thought it was super weird, but it was like a real kumbaya situation. And then the meeting ends and Trump tells Schumer to come over and basically says, hey, I'll tell you what, I'll give you your tunnel if you give me my wall. Obviously, the border wall with Mexico. And Schumer was like, well, hey, I can't do that. You know, I'd be selling out Democrats. And pretty much from that point, not only has the Trump administration been opposed to the Gateway Project, Trump threatened to veto an entire budget deal that would have, you know, a $1 trillion spending deal to keep the government open if it included any money for Gateway. So it wasn't like he was just against it. He was against anything happening if it was allowed to continue. So he's really been the stopping point. And, they've been blocking loans for the project. They've been blocking grants for the project. And everybody kind of figures there's got to be some kind of deal, but nobody's quite sure how to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that meeting in the aftermath is kind of a perfect example of, you know, the promise of the Trump administration on infrastructure. He came into office pledging to do the biggest spending on infrastructure projects in American history, talked about how he's a builder, comes from New York, built all these big buildings. You mentioned in the piece, helped to kind of create the New York skyline. And it was, you know, one of his selling points that America is falling apart and I'm the guy who can fix it. And I'm going to do that. And then sounded great at this meeting. And then it stopped and the Trump administration became, very outspoken opponent of the Gateway Project. And Infrastructure Week, which you also mentioned, has turned into a joke now, that it's a meme, basically. Yeah. That it's always Infrastructure Week, and Infrastructure Week is a joke because they're not actually going to do anything on infrastructure. So I guess just talk to me about how Infrastructure Week went from the great promise of the Trump administration to a punchline.
Right. Well, one thing I guess has been bad timing, because every time they announced that I think the first time they announced it was going to be their big Infrastructure Week, he ended up firing Comey. And then I think the next Infrastructure Week was the first Stormy Daniels news. So it's all, you know, it's always, I think Charlottesville happened during one of the Infrastructure Weeks, the race riot. So there's definitely been some bad timing involved. But also, obviously, it reflects this larger idea that he did say, you know, I'm going to be the builder. I alone can fix it. I like building big things. That's what I do. And he's come out with, you know, he had an infrastructure advisory board, which got disbanded after Charlotte. At Charlottesville, he has this big infrastructure plan, which is originally supposed to be we're going to spend $1 trillion during the transition. Jared Kushner was meeting with people and making it sound like they were going to spend $1 trillion. Gateway was on this list that circulated out of the White House. It was the number one priority on this list. And then the actual Trump infrastructure plan, it turns out to be it's $200 billion and it's not even new money, which is really a way of saying it's no money at all. And essentially, the Trump infrastructure plan is for other people to build infrastructure. What they've really talked about is reducing the federal share of infrastructure projects, which is sometimes as high as 80%. They want it to be more like 20%. And really, that's their sort of argument against Gateway, is that, you know, this is a New York, New Jersey project. New York, New Jersey should pay for it. Why should the United States care about essentially an infrastructure project that's vital to the future of the media and financial capital of the world?
Yeah, Michael, why should the United States care about whether a bunch of, you know, commuters coming into the through the Northeast Corridor to New York die in a tunnel or can't get to their jobs? I mean, obviously, that's not an issue that affects the rest of the United States, right?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of economic impact a day. And really, I mean, I think that if you wanted to imagine a scenario for a really quick, you know, how fast could we get into a national recession? I guess for, you know, probably the first thing you'd say is like come some kind of like cyber crash that created a financial crisis. But number two would probably be this tunnel failing that they had to shut down access to New York City. The metropolitan areas of the United States, which we have to say, like, you know, that's where Hillary Clinton got most of her vote, was from cities and their sort of immediate suburbs. But that's what makes the American economy go. It's the New Yorks, it's the Los Angeles, it's but it's also, you know, Austin and Chicago and places in the middle of the country too. But you can't just sort of hand wave away the impact of the major economic engines of this country. There definitely is a sense that I got when I was reporting this story is that particularly train projects, trains are seen as like democratic infrastructure, kind of, you know, roads are, you know, yeah, sure, we're for roads, we're for infrastructure, we're for, you know, Trump has actually tried to kind of ruralify a lot of American infrastructure programs. But there's a sense that, like, you know, not all, you know, infrastructure used to be bipartisan, but stuff like trains and subways and bike paths and pedestrians and, you know, sort of urban projects are now increasingly seen as like democratic infrastructure. And why should Republicans help cities thrive and attract more people who are just going to vote Democrat?
I got to tell you, you're just depressing me unbelievably right now to you know, talk about Democrat infrastructure versus Republican infrastructure.
That's why they pay me the big bucks, Ben.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as if the world isn't depressing enough that we've now completely made partisan how we fix different parts of the country and how we prioritize that. But that's what we've done. So that's where we are. One really interesting little tidbit in your story, you mentioned that among the things that people have considered to try to get Trump back on board and excited about doing projects like this is to name this new tunnel after Trump. It could be the Trump Tunnel, you know, for the Northeast Corridor. And at first, someone might think, well, that's a joke. Nobody would really take that seriously. But it certainly seems serious to me. Were they joking when they said that?
No, I don't think they were entirely joking. I mean, I think what they certainly were serious about is this idea that somehow they have to flatter Trump into thinking that this project is going to be in his interest. They got to get him to stop thinking about it as a blue state project. And again, it is the entire, you know, the entire Acela corridor depends on it. But let's also face it. I think it was, I think there's 16 senators from the Acela states and 15 of them are Democrats. So he's not crazy to think of the Northeast as kind of, you know, not his base, even though it's his actual, you know, where he grew up and where he made all his riches. I think there is this feeling that somehow we've got to make this guy think that he's going to be the winner if this thing gets built. And in fairness, you know, we talked about how this is democratic infrastructure. There are a lot of serious people in the Trump administration, serious conservatives, who may think that the federal role in infrastructure has gotten too large and that states should put more skin in the game. But they also, they believe in infrastructure, if not, you know, the federal share of the Gateway Project. And they were very effective in kind of convincing Trump, you know, playing to his vanities that he can be the Republican hero. He can be the hero of the Freedom Caucus if he kills this thing. This is just a Chuck Schumer scam to, you know, to pull one over on you. Everybody's saying that Chuck Schumer is out negotiating you. They played his vanities very well. And I think people on the other side are thinking, God, we gotta figure out a way to flatter this man child into doing it our way. And obviously naming the tunnel is sort of the most obvious way to do it.
We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Mike Grunwald. But first, a quick break.
And now, a word from our sponsor. A message from Morgan Stanley. When it comes to investing, the methods people use to make choices often aren't rational. Group thinking and confirmation bias can subconsciously impact your approach. For example, some research shows that people prefer stocks that have easy-to-pronounce ticker symbols. Acknowledging and overcoming that bias helps you make a more informed investment decision. Thoughtful decision-making and following the data can help you maintain intellectual independence. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/heard. That's morganstanley.com/HERD. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC. Member SIPC.
Well, let's talk about worst case scenarios if the money isn't ultimately there and the project cannot be completed and that bridge over the Hackensack is not replaced and a new tunnel is not built to bring New Jersey Transit and Amtrak trains into New York City. Let's play out that scenario where none of that happens. What's the worst case scenario for the New York, New Jersey region and indeed the whole Northeast Corridor?
Well, I think one thing to point out is that, and this is something that proponents of the project, and I think it's fair to say that we're both, you know, we're both among the people who think this thing has got to get done. It is true that these tunnels, particularly since Superstorm Sandy, really are falling apart and they really do need to be replaced. But kind of people make it sound like they're about to collapse and, you know, they're going to be like millions of people trapped underwater in some kind of horror movie scenario and thousands of people are going to get killed. That's not the way this thing is going to shut down. What's going to happen is there's going to be an electrical short and the, you know, the engineers are going to go in and they're just eventually going to decide that this thing is so unreliable that it's not going to make sense to keep fixing it. And they're going to have to shut down at least one way, which would reduce traffic 75%. And there you really would have essentially paralysis where, you know, people from New Jersey wouldn't be able to get into Manhattan. You'd create the, you know, probably the greatest work at home experiment in American history. But it really were, I saw there was, and now I've forgotten the numbers, but just one insurance company ran the numbers on how it would affect them. And it was going to cost them millions of dollars every day in lost productivity. And you really are going to see, I mean, right now, New York City's in a fight with London to be the financial capital of the world. And this is the sort of thing that, that could tip things. You know, New York is the media capital. New York is just big business. And it depends on access. That's the way economies work is, you know, the smoother the transportation system, the more you can move people and goods, the more people are going to want to use it. And New York is going to become a place that people are not going to want to use because it's going to be too much of a hassle.
Yeah, I think people, you know, don't, you know, they think about that catastrophe situation you mentioned as like this horrible, scary thing from a Michael Bay movie or something. And that certainly is not the likely scenario. But the likely scenario is this, you know, just continued slowness and, you know, hit to productivity. And anybody who goes back and forth between Washington and New York a lot, you know, knows the Acela Wi-Fi sucks and that slows down productivity and knows that, you know, you're often going to have to wait between Newark and New York City. And that's lost work time often. That's lost productivity time and people right. working from home maybe aren't doing as much as they would if they were in their offices with colleagues. And obviously, if you're competing with London and elsewhere and you've got these ancient, crappy, awful trains in and out of the city, you know, maybe you put more people in London than you do in New York. And it is a frustrating thing to a lot of people because it's not obvious and sexy.
And also, and let's face it, I mean, you and I both lived the financial crisis. And, you know, that's a perfect example of, you know, it's sort of like people were talking about reforms for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for years. People were talking about how you need, you know, better financial regulation, macroprudential regulation. You need better capital rules. And obviously none of that happened until you had a crisis. And then lots of it happened. And you had Dodd-Frank and you had, you know, Basel III and you had a lot of good reforms. I'm sure if those tunnels really did shut down, suddenly people would get a lot more motivated to build this gateway project. But unlike, you know, financial reforms, you know, it's, you know, building a massive tunnel 3 miles under the Hudson River is not the kind of thing that you can just snap your fingers and get done. You know, this country is pretty good at responding to emergencies usually, but it's not really good at thinking about emergencies in advance. And often, you know, just like we didn't get the TARP, you know, the bank bailouts until the, you know, Lehman Brothers failed and the market crashed. It may be that we don't get the gateway tunnel until, you know, the tunnel fails and we have the different kind of metaphorical crash.
Yeah. And my biggest fear about all this infrastructure is that there is no crisis, no obvious crisis, no collapsing tunnel or bridge. It's just a slow burn of less economic growth, less productivity. And we just don't do anything about it because it's not immediately obvious to us that it's happening.
Right. And to go beyond, I mean, aside from their kind of sham infrastructure plan, you'd think that the Trump administration, you know, with this guy, and I have stories in that piece about how Trump, even during the campaign, was sort of telling everybody, like, you know, like, aren't you going to miss building stuff? He's like, oh, no, believe me, I'm going to be a builder. You'd think that even with the money we already spend on infrastructure, that Trump would be like at least picking some big project somewhere and trying to drive that forward. But there's just no evidence of that anywhere at the Department of Transportation. You can't think of anything that Trump is doing infrastructure wise anywhere in the country aside from that wall, which, as everybody knows, is, you know, is not really happening yet.
All right. Well, we're talking ourselves into Great Depression here. So let's lighten it up a little bit and talk about potential scenarios where the tide turns a little bit and maybe some of these big projects that you mentioned get done and Trump decides that he can take credit for them. And one scenario in my mind is the midterm elections. And let's say Democrats do, in fact, retake the House, which seems, you know, quite possible. Senate a little bit less likely. But if Democrats do get, you know, one body and can now at least in part set the agenda, one of the only things Trump might be able to get done in the second half of his first term heading towards potential reelection is some kind of deal with Democrats on infrastructure and particularly, you know, this gateway project and maybe a couple of more. Do you see that as possibility if Democrats take the House that once again you could see Trump, the bipartisan deal maker, deciding to do some infrastructure, or am I just too hopeful on that front?
Well, look, I mean, I can definitely spin that scenario, right? Because first of all, here's this guy who was a Democrat. He was never an ideologue. He was always a deal maker. You know, that was sort of his appeal in some ways, that he was like, you know, he doesn't come from the Republican establishment. He certainly talked about that. You know, people who met with him during the transition were really really positive about it. And you can see in the story, I quoted a lot of people around who are sort of Trump allies, particularly from New York, people who have been involved in his sort of infrastructure thinking, who say he wants to do it. There's definitely a sense that he's, you know, a lot of complaints that he's been, I had a few quotes in there that people saying he's been boxed in by the Heritage crowd. This idea that the sort of the anti-government ideologues have sort of gotten their hooks into Trump. And they're thinking of people like Mick Mulvaney, also Jeff Rosen, who's less known. He's the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, is, you know, a real Amtrak skeptic and is sort of a, you know, pretty much a limited government conservative, doesn't believe in big spending on this stuff. And certainly from people like that who say, like, look, he wants to build, you know, he'd love to do deals with Schumer. You know, that's what he does. And yeah, you could certainly nothing else is going to get done. That said, I think there is a little an element of wishful thinking in looking at sort of, you know, what Trump might do, because pretty much what Trump has done since he's become president has been, you know, very much in line with the Heritage Foundation crowd. And whether they're boxing him in or just appealing to, you know, a kind of political side of him that maybe we didn't know existed, he has been very consistent about reaching out to his base and only his base. And there has been a lot of political upside for him, you would think, in sort of reaching out to the middle, whether there's a Republican Congress or a Democratic Congress. Everybody likes infrastructure, right? And he has not done that.
I wonder, Mike, why it is that the argument is made for tax cuts that they will ultimately pay for themselves with faster economic growth. And, you know, they usually don't and probably won't in this instance. But, you know, the argument for spending a bunch of money on infrastructure and putting a sizable federal share of it is that ultimately it pays off in greater worker productivity and more people wanting to invest and grow their businesses. There's a very pro-growth case for spending money on infrastructure that really could ultimately recoup the cost. But that argument either doesn't get made or doesn't break through. Do people make that argument to you?
You know, that's a great point. I mean, there was a big kind of a hubbub a few years ago when Republicans and the Congressional Budget Office, they started talking about dynamic scoring, right? Which a lot of people thought, oh, that's just their way of trying to make their tax cuts look like they pay for themselves. But there were some people on the left who were like, hey, you know, dynamic scoring makes a certain amount of sense. And particularly because infrastructure, things like infrastructure should be scored as boosting economic growth and thereby boosting tax revenues and over time reducing the deficit. And And we saw a perfect example of that in 2009 with the Obama stimulus, which, of course, you know, I'm a little biased about because I wrote an entire frickin' book about it. But at the time, you know, people were like $800 billion. It was $300 billion of tax cuts, but $500 billion of spending. That's so irresponsible. It's going to blow up the deficit. And it did for a year and a half. But it also, by June 2009, we were out of the Great Recession. And by 2010, we were starting to gain jobs again. And, you know, by 2011, 2012, you're starting to see that deficit come down. So it's sort of a real life example of, you know, yeah, actually, if you give people money that they can spend, and if you do repaving projects and, you know, high speed rail or higher speed rail projects and all the kind of things that were in the clean energy, and you build solar farms and you build wind farms, that actually can have boost economic growth and ultimately does not have to be a deficit buster. But to, you know, that's a long-winded way of saying, like, you're right, nobody talks about that. But you know, the growth of the country depends, you know, American competitiveness does depend on our infrastructure. It also depends on our regulatory system and our tax system and, you know, making that more efficient. Absolutely. And it depends on educating workers and having a really good workforce. But certainly, you know, being able to get places and being able to, you know, flush your toilet and have it not go into the bay, and having it, being able to drive on a road without ruining your axles. These are all things that boost American productivity and ultimately in the long run make us a competitive and vibrant country. But again, it's the sort of long-term thinking that this particular democracy doesn't seem to be all that awesome at.
Yeah, it doesn't. Chinese seem to be good at it. Maybe we just have the wrong system.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a lot easier.
We just need to go to a Chinese autocracy.
Yeah, it's a lot easier when you, you know, I bet they'd have a lot easier time building that ventilation shaft in the middle of an urban area when the people who get moved out of the way don't really get to complain about it.
No, they just disappear and nobody ever sees them again. Yes. All right. So, Mike, let's end on a slightly lighter note. And this is something that Jenny, our producer, noted to me that I didn't know, that Morning Transportation has a playlist on Spotify of transportation related tunes, which everybody should subscribe to. But I picture you like riding the Acela and reporting out this piece and like popping on your headphones and listening to your best transportation related music and songs. Do you have any particular favorites from the American Songbook on transportation?
Well, I think for this story, and I believe you're somewhat of a deadhead. Am I right?
I was in earlier years.
I think you got to kind of think about Casey Jones, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, driving that train, high on whatever it is that, for us, it's high on journalism. Watch your speed. And then I was also thinking that since before those tunnels were built in the early 1900s, basically the only way to get into New York City from New Jersey was you had to take a ferry across the Hudson. So I was thinking that that Don't Pay the Ferryman.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Since that might be what we're heading back to if those tunnels do shut down.
Exactly. We're all going to be like Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr having to take, boats across the Hudson to shoot each other in Hoboken, New Jersey, because the trains will no longer take us back and
exactly.
forth.
Exactly. What are your infrastructure songs? I want to hear it.
Well, Casey Jones would definitely be in there. I would throw Truckin' in from the Dead catalog. I'm trying to think if there are others.
I was thinking Midnight Train to Georgia. Midnight Train to Georgia could possibly.
Yeah, Midnight Train to Georgia is good. Yeah, Ramblin' Man, Allman Brothers, you know, born in the backseat of a Greyhound bus. You know, you got to throw that on there.
We are so old, Ben. We are so old.
I'm trying to think of something like new that my kids listen to, you know, like an Eminem song or something. But I'm just feeling crickety and old and rickety. But, yeah, you know, okay, so listeners, bail us out here. You can, you know, email me or tweet at me at Morning Money Ben, your favorite transportation songs that you listen to as you ride on the declining and falling apart rails of America. Mike Runwald, reporter extraordinaire, definitely read his piece in Politico magazine on the Gateway Project and the problems of infrastructure, and he's written books about the stimulus and the Everglades and the Army Corps of Engineers and all kinds of other cool stuff that you should check out. Mike, thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Ben.
What everybody's saying.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks so much to Mike Runwald for joining us. Thanks to my brand new producer, Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.